Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Julie Batalana, professor at Harvard Business School and the Harvard Kennedy School, and founder of the Social Innovation and Change Initiative. We're going to talk about her new book, Power for All, How It Really Works and Why It's Everyone's Business, a book and a vision that I think works on a lot of levels. And to learn more, you can go to powerforallbook.com. That's one word, powerforallbook.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Power for All is, if you'll excuse the self-reference, a deceptively powerful book. It begins as a book about the meaning of power, and if you will, the power of power. It offers principles and practices for the understanding, attainment, and exercise of power in our individual lives, in our relationships. And I've already found its lessons meaningful in my own life. Based on its principles, I find myself noticing differently. And noticing is, in a way, all we've got. As William James wrote, the mind is made up of what it feeds upon. We are what we pay attention to. This is already a useful book. Then it widens out to offer insights and stories on the exercise of power in and by organizations. It then widens again to look at power in our collective movements. It then takes on the issues of power in our politics and governance and in our relationships with technology. Both are particularly relevant and crucial today as we deal with the overwhelming power of money and the trap of minority rule in our politics and the insidious influence of algorithms on our attention and our emotions, perhaps below the level of our conscious control by technology. So by now, it's already two valuable books. It then becomes a rallying cry, ending with what I believe is nothing less than a call for individuals to not only understand and assert their power, but also to join collectively to use this power to remake society by rebalancing power relationships, including racial, gender, financial, and political. That is a lot to take on, and the book seems to grow in ambition as I read it, and it's a lot for us to talk about today. Julie Batalana is a professor of organizational behavior and social innovation at the Harvard Business School and the Harvard Kennedy School, where she's also the founder and faculty chair of the Social Innovation and Change Initiative. Her research examines the politics of change in organizations and in society, especially focusing on organizations and individuals that initiate and implement changes that diverge from the taken for granted. She's co-author of the forthcoming book, The Working Manifesto, as well as the one we're talking about today, co-authored with Tiziana Cazziaro, Power for All, How It Really Works, and Why It's Everyone's Business. Welcome, Julie Batalana, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terrence. I'm delighted to be with you today.
And let me tell people, we are recording this conversation Tuesday, August 24th. So, first, how are you? How have you coped with the pandemic and the other challenges that we faced in the last year?
Well, Terrence, the past 18 months have been such a complicated period for so many people. So I certainly cannot complain. I've had the chance of going through this pandemic without being directly affected by it. But what has very much been on my mind is, how can I be helpful? What can I do? And the reason why the question has been so acute to me is because the crisis we're facing at the moment is not only a health crisis, it is obviously a health crisis and a devastating one, but it is also an economic and a social crisis characterized by rising inequalities on top of an environmental crisis. And so as we look back in history, those crises are traumatic and difficult moments, but they are also the moments when societies can reinvent themselves. And so I feel this acute need for all of us to participate in the change. We cannot stay the course. We have to make changes happen. And in fact, my hope is that that book, Power for All, will be a tool for a number. And in fact, there are so many people today who want to be part of the change, who want to reinvent our society to make it be a greener, fairer, and more democratic society.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So, briefly, how do you see your path to the work you find yourself doing today? You can go way back, the moments of decision, mentors, turning points, that sort of thing.
So let me go way back then. I as you can hear to my accent, I'm not a pure Bostonian. I live in Boston. I'm a French-American Bostonian. I actually grew up in the south of France, in Marseille. Marseille is a bustling port, and it's a quite diverse city. And my interest in power and inequalities, I think, really goes back to my time growing up in Marseille. As I said, it's a diverse city, and yet everywhere I looked around, I could see how some people were enabled having access to more resources just based on the color of their skin, based on the area of the city in which they live, based on their accent, based on their gender, and so on, right? And then others, because of their demographics, because of their trajectories, didn't have the same access to resources, didn't have the same kind of power. And so growing up as a child, I was already deeply interested in these questions and questioning what I could myself do to better understand these inequalities and to help address them. And so that set me on a trajectory to actually become an academic. I started turning to the existing research in economics, in sociology, in political science, to try and better understand these inequalities. And one thing leading to another, I decided to go for a PhD studying organizations and the role of organizations in the reproduction of inequalities and what people in organizations can do to try and fight these inequalities. And so that's how I really started studying change within organizations and within society. And then when I later became a professor, a lot of my teaching and research continued to concentrate on the politics of change, on the critical issue of social justice. And I then created at the Harvard Kennedy School, now I created it 5 years ago, the Social Innovation and Change Initiative. That's an initiative that aims to help social change makers navigate the challenges of social change implementation. So I have the great privilege of working with social change makers on the Harvard campus and much beyond. And those are the people who today are making a real difference and helping us reinvent our societal model.
Thank you. Thank you. That makes very great sense. Do you remember a moment in your youth when some of the stark inequalities struck you?
So I'm going to share with you a personal story then. I grew up in a family that has Italian roots in Marseille. And so I vividly remember our weekly dinners when we would get all together at my grandparents' place. And I grew up with parents who were doing everything they could to empower me and just tell me that the sky was the limit and that I could think about whatever I would want to do. If I worked hard enough and tried to understand people and things, then I would be able to have the kind of impact that I was aspiring to. But yet when I joined those weekly dinners, the dynamics were quite different. what was happening at those weekly dinners, and I'm sure it's going to ring a bell for many of the people listening, because again, it's not always a question of gender. It can be a question of race. It can be a question of accent and so on, right? There are so many different things that can, again, be a source of advantages or, on the contrary, play against us. But I remember as a young girl and then a young woman attending these dinners and realizing that men at the table were basically the one deciding on the agenda of the conversation, and that we women had to be in charge of all the domestic chores and just comply. And I was shocked, obviously, by the division of labor and the power hierarchy. That's not how I talked about it at the time, but clearly it was a power hierarchy that existed and at the time, and it pervaded every aspect of life in that broader family. And so that's something that I found to be truly unjust, and that really set me on the trajectory of trying to think more deeply about where do these inequalities come from and what can we do to address them. And again, I had also this deep awareness that I was truly not that disadvantaged. Like, yes, I was a woman in an environment in which it was easier at the time to be a man, but the color of my skin was such that It was a source of advantage in the kind of society in which we were at the time and we're still are today. So to me, the critical thing was, if I experience these kind of inequalities, then what can I do to help others who experience much deeper, much more impactful and traumatic inequality?
I was originally aware of your work on social innovation. And when I got your book, I hadn't asked about the title. I was curious, you know, when I heard you had a new book, I said, well, send it to me. And I was a bit surprised that it was about power. How did you choose that focus?
Well, if you think about it, when you think about social justice, when you think about social innovation, what you have to do as a social change maker is implement changes. And if you want to be effective in implementing changes, you have to understand the politics of change. So power is core and central to social innovation. It's core and central to any kind of social change. And in fact, in my work at the Social Innovation and Change Initiative, working with social change makers across the world, what I've come to see is that when they fail, they often fail because they do not understand power. They tend to think about power sometimes as a dirty side of things. Mm-hmm, they don't want to spend too much time dealing with this. But the reality is that you have to harness power if you want to be able to have any kind of impact. And if you think about the problems that you mentioned, right, from sexism to racism, economic inequalities, other forms of social inequalities, the environmental crisis that we're facing today, the critical dangers facing our democracy. If we want to address all these challenges, if we want to rise to the occasion, we have to understand power, because power is key to the reproduction of all the issues. And it's also going to be key if we want to be able to change the status quo and implement change.
Yes. And my sense actually is that for some reason, I think to many people, this issue of power is almost like water to fish, that they don't really notice that they're swimming in power dynamics. That gets left out, and they look at, you know, what's the program, what's the policy, what's the tactic. And what you're saying is that all of that will depend on a accurate analysis of the power.
Absolutely. And the reason why we wrote this book with my dear colleague, co-author and friend, Tiziana Casciaro, is that our objective was to equip people with infrared glasses. Right? Hopefully you read this book and then you're able to understand power dynamics in interpersonal relationships, in organizations, and in society. And then once you understand, what we've seen through our teaching and through our research is that then hopefully that will help you unleash your potential to have the kind of impact you aspire to at home, at work, and possibly in society.
Can I ask you, you mentioned your co-author, Tiziana Casciaro. Can you just, this seems like on the one hand, it's about a lot of things, but it's also written, you can tell there's a very personal voice here. What was that writing process like?
Well, it was a delight. Tiziana and myself have known each other for many, many years now. And we have conducted research together. And importantly, we've both been teaching about power and influence at our respective institutions. And so over the past 15 years, as we were doing research together on the politics of change and teaching our students on the politics of change and the role of power in the reproduction of existing inequalities and hierarchies, what Tiziana and I did is that we were in constant communication, right? We were sharing with each other some of the patterns we saw, some of the challenges we faced. We were sharing about our hopes. And all of those conversations led us to realize, and I think that happened probably 3 to 4 years ago now, that there was a need for a new kind of book on power. And let me explain that. Like we both came to the conclusion that what was needed was a book that would not only talk about the social psychology of power, or only talk about power in organizations, or only talk about power in society. Don't get me wrong, all of these books are tremendously important, but what we wanted to do was to help people connect all those levels of analysis. You need to understand power in interpersonal relationships, in organizations, and in society. And we wanted to provide the tools so that people would be able to do that and understand how their personal life is connected to what's happening at the systemic level when it comes to power. So we had that same aspiration. And so from that standpoint, we knew we both wanted to write the same kind of book. And then the other thing is that our experience teaching that content to our students and to people across the world, because we had this great opportunity over the past 20 years to travel, to meet people on the ground as we were conducting our research. I had the privilege of working with a lot of social change makers. And in working with these people with very, very different walks of life, we also came to understand that they had deep misconceptions in mind about power, mostly three of them. The first one is this idea that the people who have power somehow have some personal characteristic that make them powerful in every situation. And so power would be a possession if only you had this characteristic. The second misconception about power is that power is only for the people at the top, for the generals, for the presidents, for the CEOs, for the prime ministers, and so on. And the third misconception that's probably the most widespread, and we already talked about it briefly, is this idea that power is dirty. Mm. And so people would tell us things like, you know what, I think that I don't have the personal trait, I'm not that powerful, and anyway, I'm not one of the people at the top, so power is really not for me, but good for me, because at the end of the day, I'm not getting my hands dirty. And this is highly problematic, because if you turn your back on power, then you let others gain ever more power, and you let them concentrate power in their hands, and that's when we all get into trouble. And so Tiziana and I had the same objective. We wanted to debunk the fallacies.
Yes.
We wanted to write a book linking the personal, the organizational, and the societal levels of analysis. And then it was, as I said, a joy to work together and bring our different experiences, knowledge of different sets of literatures together to then bring life to all of these ideas. And I should also say that together we interviewed more than 100 people over the past 2 years as we were writing the book. So that was also a joy. And all of these people, some of them are in the book, some of them are not in the book, but they've tremendously contributed to our understanding of power, and they're really part of what's in the book.
Very good. So as I said, the book begins with the meaning of power and sets out kind of some principles of what is power and what is not. And you've just laid out to some extent what it is not. It is not those three things which are widely believed, and not just believed, but as you have pointed out, very influential. And influential not just in what we look out and see, but influential in how people think about themselves, their role in the world, what to take on, all that sort of thing. By the same token, you set forth some very simple principles of what power is. And as you said, I think you want people to gain a laser focus on what power is so they can, as I sort of said in the introduction, train their attention on it and begin to scan for those things which make up the power dynamics around them, enable them to have power, and so on. So what are the principles of understanding and mastering power dynamics?
So in the book, we distill power down to what we call its fundamentals, right? The principles that you were talking about. And so to do so, we first define it. So what is power? It is the ability to influence others' behavior, be it through persuasion or coercion. But a definition is not an explanation. So I would say defining power is not enough to understand it. The next critical question is, where does power come from? And the answer to this question is what we refer to as the fundamentals of power. So as we explained in the first chapter, power derives from controlling access to resources others value. Right? I have power over you if I control access to resources that you value. And you have power over me if you control access to resources that I value. So you may, for example, Terence, control access to a budget, right, that mm-hmm. I need to complete the project that I'm currently working on in my organization. And if so, you certainly have some power over me. But then obviously it is up to you to decide how you're going to use this power. You may decide to not use it. You may decide to use it to advance your own personal goals to my detriment. Or alternatively, you may decide to use it to truly empower me and enable me to succeed. Now, the one thing I want to note that is important is that we human beings do not only value money and material possessions. We do value money and material possessions, but we also value other resources, including psychological resources, such as achievement, recognition, or affiliation. And so let's think about another source of power. You may actually want to be associated with the moral values that I stand for.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, that also gives me some power over you. And this is precisely the kind of source of power that has enabled social change makers like Gandhi, Mandela, Martin Luther King, and more recently, Malala Yousafzai and Greta Thunberg to rally people around their causes.
And going back to what we were saying power is not, if you look at either Malala or Greta Thunberg, they do not possess the givens of what would give them power. Their power comes from these other understandings, part of which, as you say, is their moral strength, their moral clarity.
Yes, absolutely. Because then the moment you understand the fundamentals of power, you get to understand that you can immediately debunk the fallacies, right? Because if power is about access, right, control over access to valued resources, then it follows from that power is never a personal possession, right? That makes no sense. You have a lot of relationships in your life and you have a great deal of power in some and less in others. And you're still the same person bringing the same personal characteristics, but in some contexts, they are going to be valued more than in other contexts. You also get to understand when you understand the fundamentals of power that power is not only for the people at the top.
Yes.
And this is why you're talking about Malala, Greta Thunberg, like they were not and they are not the people at the top of existing power hierarchies, but still they've become very powerful. And so this is absolutely critical and a big misconception, again, that people have in mind. People tend to think that authority and power are the same, but they're not, right? Authority can be a source of power.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not necessarily a guarantee of power. And conversely, what we have to be aware of is that you do not need to be at the top of a hierarchy to have any kind of power. In fact, in the research that Tiziana and I have conducted together about change makers in organizations, we got to see that the more effective change makers are not the people at the top. Quite often, they are middle managers, frontline workers. But what these people have in common is that they are central in the network of the organization. They are the people to whom others go for advice.
Mm-hmm.
They are the people others trust. And these people are more effective at influencing others because trust is a huge conduit of influence. So again, you get to see that power and authority are very different and that this is something that we have to account for. And when you understand the fundamentals of power, you also get to understand that power is not inherently dirty, right? Power is the energy you need to get anything done. That's the energy that Malala and Greta need to get anything done. But the critical question is, what will you do to acquire power and how are you going to use that power? So the corruption, if anywhere, is not in power itself. It's in our human psychology. We have to be careful not to abuse the power we have, but there are things we can do individually and collectively to make sure that we hold ourselves and we hold those in power accountable.
Yeah, and while it is easy to point to abusers of power, authoritarians, egomaniacs, narcissists, and so on, you point out in your story, I believe, of Vera Cordero, that as she's building an organization and being effective in social change, she finds herself becoming a little shaky on how she's handling power.
Yes, absolutely. So you're talking about Vera. Vera is one of the amazing social change makers, social entrepreneurs with whom we met as we were writing this book. And I had been following the work of Vera for a number of years, actually, myself. So Vera is the founder of Instituto Dara in Brazil, which is an organization whose mission is to try and help families get out of extreme poverty, but in a sustainable way. And for Vera, it all started with the work that she was doing as a doctor, working in hospitals in Rio de Janeiro and seeing sick kids who would keep coming back to the hospital. And she felt that things could be done to help these kids if only they didn't have to deal with the family situation that they had to deal with, where their parents were so poor that they had no resources and no options to really be able to take care of their kids in the way that they wanted. So she created Instituto Dara to make the change happen with the multidimensional approach, sort of realizing if you want to help these families get out of poverty, if you want to save the lives of these kids, you have to take care of a number of things. You have to take care of healthcare, yes, but you also have to help them with housing. You also have to help them with, you know, access to employment and so on. And so she developed a very powerful model that is now being replicated actually not only in Brazil, but across the world, and that has been very effective. But Vera is a very interesting person when it comes to her relationship with power, because what she described to us is how reluctant she was to get closer to powerful people or to even view herself as powerful, because she felt early on in her career that power was dirty. And then at some point she came to realize that if she wanted to get anything done, power was in fact the energy she would need to get things done. So she started building the networks that she needed to be able to do the fundraising for a not-for-profit organization, to put the not-for-profit on the radar, to be able to help more families, to have more impact. And she became quite successful. She actually grew the organization, helped many more families, got recognized through a number of awards and fellowships. She became a Schwab Fellow, among other very well-known fellowships, and was regarded as one of the most successful social entrepreneurs in Brazil and across the world. And she had the honesty to tell us that at that point, she vividly remembers having a conversation with people within our organization, as well as family members, who turned to her and told her, Vera, you're not yourself anymore. Right? I mean, think about it. Like, you're not listening to us as much as you used to. What are your priorities? And so Vera came to realize that power had slowly but surely changed her psychology. Mm-hmm. She had become more self-centered, right? She was also a little bit more hubristic. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that happened only to Vera. That's something that can happen to every one of us, especially if it happened to Vera when she has such a social orientation and is such an admirable human being, right? We all have this risk when we have power in our hands to become more hubristic and to become more self-centered. But the good news, as Vera experienced, and mm-hmm. as we explain in the book based on research as well, is that there are things we can do. Like, if hubris is one of the poisons of power, then what you can do to just go against that poison is have an antidote, and it's humility. So you need to cultivate humility as the antidote to hubris. And then if self-centeredness is the other poison that's associated with power, what you can do is, again, try and cultivate the antidote, which is empathy. And what we do see in our work is that people who cultivate humility and empathy are far less likely to abuse their power and more likely to have the kind of collective orientation that will enable them to use their power to also empower others. And that's precisely what Vera has been able to do. But as she herself would say, that took some work. And importantly, she didn't rely only on herself. She also created organizational systems and processes, because she knew that she would need to be held accountable by others to make sure she would not ever again abuse our power.
I'm really glad we went into that, that you chose to go into that story in some depth, that the book includes stories like that. And what you see is that, as I said, the authors lay out principles, they also lay out pitfalls, and they also lay out practices. There is a how-to kind of approach to this that, I think in some of the early stages, I felt as if, this would be a self-help book or a business school kind of book on how to succeed, because it does. It analyzes what's going on in the dynamics, and then it gives you tools to handle it. And then, as I've said a couple of times, then the ambition widens out, and I see that if you can get the fundamentals of how it works and how to cultivate it and how to use it well, then there's bigger purposes for your power. Let me tell people that this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Julie Batalana. She's a professor at Harvard Business School and the Harvard Kennedy School. She's founder there of the Social Innovation and Change Initiative, and we're talking about her new book, Power for All, How It Really Works and Why It's Everyone's Business, a book and a vision that I believe works on a lot of levels. And you can learn more by going to Power for All Book. Power for All Book, all one word, powerforallbook.com. I just want to mention, and you can add a note, but I don't want to dawdle on it too long, but I thought it was just a great example when you talked about Lyndon Johnson. And so I'll just say quickly what I got, and maybe we move on, maybe you add to it, that he was very powerful, but presidents are powerful. But it wasn't about being president as to why he was powerful. It's how he gained powerful, how this ungainly Texan became the most powerful person in the country, perhaps even before he was president. And it was that he had an innate understanding of a lot of what you talk about in terms of principles and practices. But then, as you point out, once he had actually, due to the assassination of his predecessor, become president and actually had the role of being the most powerful person in the world, perhaps, he ended up losing his power because of misusing it in Vietnam.
It's interesting because if you think about indeed the fundamentals of power, right? Again, power is about controlling access to resources that others value. Then you get to understand that there are always and only two key questions that you have to be able to understand if you want to understand power in any relationships, in any situations, right? The first question is, what do people value? What do they need and want? And the second question is, who controls access to these resources? And if you think about LBJ, what's truly interesting when you study how he built his power, how he gained power, is that he clearly understood the fundamentals of power. Think about it in the Senate. He was able to understand what people needed and wanted, all those different senators, right? He was talking to them, he was asking the questions, he was making sure that he understood what they needed and wanted. And then he found ways to provide to them what they needed and wanted. And that's how he was able to influence these senators in such an effective way during his years in the Senate. Now, the question becomes, as you highlighted, right, what is it that happened then when he became president? And when he became president, he was no more surrounded only by people who were just like him, right? Because if you think about the Senate at the time, he was surrounded mostly by white American men. But now he was dealing in that position as president with many different constituencies and much more diverse constituencies domestically and internationally. Then the answer to those questions, what do people need and want, is more complicated at that point. And it's going to be problematic if you start thinking that what they need and want is what you need and want.
Yeah.
Because their psychology is different from yours. And so obviously we don't want to oversimplify and it's a very complex political situation that's the one that, you know, we are discussing now and describing as to the Vietnam War. But I'll say that indeed, thinking about how is it that LBJ was able to provide answers to that critical question during his years in the Senate versus how is it that he was able to provide answers to this question as the president of the United States? Like, I think this is an interesting lens to think about his presidency and what happened and how it unfolded.
Yes. And the other thing that I think is fascinating when you talk about LBJ in the book is that you actually break down his practices, what he paid attention to in his days in the Senate, how he rose through the ranks by noticing, as you said before about an organization, who people went to for advice, who were the different sort of nodes in the networks of power within the Senate. He had the understanding, it seemed, to know what was important to pay attention to get things done.
And that kind of power mapping is a skill, right? And when I talk about power mapping, it's really understanding who has power and who doesn't in a given context, in a given environment, right? And power mapping is a critical skill for anyone who wants to be able to navigate the politics of their community, of society. So we have a lot to learn from that. And it's something that we should all try not to be blindsided. Because again, if you want to have any kind of impact within the organization that you belong to or that you work for, you better understand who has power and who doesn't so that you can start thinking about how you're going to influence people so that they can change their behaviors and adopt the change that you'd like to see them adopt so that the organization can better serve the different constituents, the different stakeholders that it is serving. So that power mapping, again, is critical, and it's something we insist on in the book.
One thing I wanted to say, I thought of it a few minutes ago when you were talking about, you know, people shy away from power because it's dirty. It seems to me that another way of thinking of power is value. By that, I mean, if I, as a person within this organization, are going to have value, it's probably going to come because I understand and use power well. If I am going to have impact for good, it's probably going to come because I understand and use power well. And if you can think about your value and your impact, those are things that don't have negative connotations to most people.
You're right. And if you think about organizations today, I think this is something that leaders, top executives have to be thinking about. We human beings have two fundamental needs, right? We have a need for safety and a need for self-esteem. And we pursue these needs differently at different points of our lives, and there are huge variations and differences for every one of us and across people, across cultures, across environments. So, but that being said, we have these two fundamental needs for safety and for self-esteem. So now think about that in the context of your organization. Let's think about that in today's context, right? The context of COVID, and there's this pandemic, and we're talking about the return to work. And there's this question of what should we do? What should companies do? Should they mandate certain things? Should they not? And then top executives, leaders are sort of thinking about what's the best way to proceed. And related to what you were just talking about and, you know, your values and how you're using your power, I think that one critical thing that leaders should keep in mind is autonomy of choice and being able to listen to the people they're working with, you know, including, and I would say most importantly, the people lower down in the hierarchy. Because, again, we value safety and self-esteem, and one channel for which we pursue this self-esteem and on the one hand and safety on the other is our autonomy. We value having an autonomy of choice. And so instead of trying to dictate top down how things should be done, what we should be doing is work together and create the kind of dialogue that's necessary for us to give autonomy to workers, to employees, so that they can participate in the critical decisions that affect their lives and their health within their organizations. So I think that leaders ought to pay more attention to, again, the autonomy of the workers, because if they want to influence them, that's a first step to take.
And that's because when you understand that what it is your workers value is safety and self-esteem, and that their self-esteem has to be part of your equation, doesn't it?
It has to be part of your equation. And if you give them enough autonomy to participate in the core strategic decisions, at least for sure the ones, again, that affect them directly, then you're also enabling them to gain a sense of safety and a sense of self-esteem, and you're going to enable them to be happier at work and as a result more effective as well. So again, contrary to some of the assumptions that, you know, it should be top down and you should dictate everything so that we can be more effective and more efficient, no, on the contrary, I would say talk to people, understand their needs and wants. Understand everything you need, the kind of environment you need to create so that you have the kind of psychological safety that will enable them to participate to the decisions, and that will then enable them to bring their best self at work.
Yeah, and I also hear there that you, being in the position of authority, the skills that you need if you're not in authority, are you still need those same skills if you are in authority for your for you to actually be able to make things work and not just, you know, set out a bunch of rules, that you don't get to give up paying attention to people's need for safety and self-esteem or what people value and who has access to it and so on at any step in the chain. Right?
I mean, absolutely. And it's very interesting, Terence, you're putting emphasis on that, because let me tell you what we've learned from the research that has been conducted. As I told you, it's critical to be able to map power relationships, right? And understand who's connected to whom in an organization if you want to then be able to have any kind of influence and implement the changes that you want to implement. Now, this network mapping is absolutely critical. Though what we get to see is that as people get higher up in the hierarchy of the organization, what happens to them is what I already described to you, right? Their psychology tends to change. That's the trap. And so they become more self-centered and more hubristic. And as a result, this skill that they had, power mapping,
yes,
is a skill that they somehow over time lose without even realizing it. And when they lose it, then it's disastrous because they cannot have the impact they want to have because they just do not have the critical information to be able to think about how to exercise their power. So you would be surprised by the number of CEOs, top executives who would come to people like Tiziana and like me and would tell us behind closed doors, I feel completely powerless. And the reason why I feel powerless is because I think that such and such changes are needed, but somehow I'm unable to, to implement these changes. And it's partly related to the fact that they've somehow lost this ability to power map. And they also, in a number of situations, need to have the humility to realize that they may not be the best positioned people to implement the change that they want to see in the organization. As I mentioned, they need to look around. They need to better understand who the central players are, those people to whom others go for advice, because these people are better positioned to push for change.
Yeah, I wonder, in your conversations with some of these CEOs who feel powerless, there must be such a moment when they realize that the skill that they used to get to the top, they've let fall.
Absolutely. And again, it takes some humility and empathy to be able to recognize, you know, this trap and avoid this trap. And I see leaders who are absolutely able to do that and others are not. And when they are not, the risk is that they continue on their trajectory thinking that they are the masters of the universe. And then they crash and burn because at the end of the day, they just lose the sources of power that they had. And so what enabled them to get to the top is then, you know, the recipe for the final disaster. So we all have to be very, very careful. And to me, the critical dimension also is the moral compass. Why is it that you want to build your power base and what are you going to do with it? What are you going to use this energy for? Is it just to advance your own personal objectives to the detriment of others? Or are you going to account for others? And are you on a mission to actually empower others? In the book, we talk about Toni Morrison, who used to tell our students that if you have any kind of power, your responsibility, your job is actually to use that power to empower others. And I very much agree. That's the kind of responsibility you have if you have power.
One quote that you had, this is about the humility piece, I think, is you said, nothing dampens illusions of invincibility and infallibility more than remembering the impermanence of our own lives and of all life. And it made me think of a quote from Norman Lear, which is this. A long time ago, this is Norman Lear speaking, a long time ago I came across this ancient saying, a man should have a garment with two pockets. In the first pocket should be a piece of paper in which is written, I am but dust and ashes. In the second pocket, another piece of paper which reads, for me the world was created. That at every moment we are both, nothing more than any other speck of dust in the universe, and yet we are also the speck of dust for whom the universe was created.
Yeah, make sure not to lose, right, the first piece of paper. That's the issue that many people are facing.
That's right. Which
is that they lose sight of the fact that, you know, we're here we are, just, you know, like one among billions and so many others preceded us. And, this deep awareness of how interconnected we are. Is so critical, and it has to come with a very good dose of humility that indeed we are impermanent, and what can we do here and now to try and help?
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about Ellen Ochoa, who became director of Johnson Space Center?
Absolutely. So it's interesting. You're going to Ellen. So I met Ellen now a few years ago and got to learn about the amazing work she has been doing at the Adjudant and Spence Center. So when she was the first Latina astronaut, I should say, and then later in her career, took the lead at the Johnson Space Center. And when she became the leader there, what she had on her mind, the vision she had, was that she was going to transform the culture of the Johnson Space Center and that she would make it a more inclusive organization. She wanted it to be the kind of organization where everyone, no matter what your demographic profile would be, no matter what your life trajectory would have been, could be successful. And so she knew that that would require a deep cultural change. And the reason why we're sharing her story in the book, in the last chapter of the book, is because she gave a lot of thinking to this issue of how can I share my power and how can I make sure that others at the Johnson Space Center will share their power. And this is a very timely issue. You were talking about systemic racism as we were starting this conversation.
Yes.
Systemic racism, sexism are issues that organizations across the country, across the world are currently dealing with. And so what we have to do now is not only recognize the issues, but address them and change the culture of organizations. And she did that. And the reason why she succeeded at doing it is because she was not thinking about it as, oh, let me try out one or two interventions and then hopefully these interventions will have impact. When I think about that, I'm thinking about some organization that may say, okay, let's have everyone go for a diversity training and then hopefully it will solve the problem.
Yeah.
Or let's promote maybe this woman of color and this gentleman of color and this other woman to the board of our organization and then hopefully that will solve these issues. Well, no, we know that that kind of, you know, just simple intervention by itself is not going to make a great deal of a difference. What you have to do is think about the distribution of resources in the organization. It is a matter of power. If you want to make organizations more inclusive, if you want to share power, you have to redistribute power. You have to think about who has access to the valuable resources in the organization. And this is precisely what Ellen Oshua did. When she took the lead, she created a whole program and a task force that looked into all of the opportunities, all of the resources made available to employees at the Johnson Space Center. And she made sure that the processes and systems would be changed so that everyone could have access to opportunities and resources that only some people initially had access to. And bear in mind that these people who had access to those resources, the privileged ones, they were not necessarily consciously doing this. They were not trying to prevent others from having the access.
Uh-huh.
But the truth is that the processes, the systems, the stories that were told were such that many people never had access to these opportunities. And so she conducted the whole review. And then one by one, they changed the processes and the systems to make the resources available more fairly to more of the employees. And that's actually changed the distribution of power in the organization in a quite effective way. But again, just promoting one or two people is not going to work. We know about the issue of tokenism.
Right? Yes.
That's not the solution. Having a one-off diversity training is not going to solve the issues. You need to do a number of things all at once, and you need to revisit all the processes and systems to change the distribution of power in a sustainable way and change the culture of the organization.
And I'm assuming that in most cases, this will not just benefit the people who seem to reap the benefits of this, that your organization, by making more individuals within your organization able to provide their highest value, you end up providing the highest value to the organization, and the organization will thrive. It's not a zero-sum game.
Absolutely. Power is not a zero-sum game. And if you think about it, if you think about the situation we were describing at the Johnson Space Center, what we can learn from what Ellen Oshua did is that when you create a more inclusive environment, when you create the kind of environment in which people can thrive no matter what their profiles are or their paths are, then you enable people to bring their best selves at work, which is absolutely critical. You enable them to be more effective, you enable them to create value for others in the organization and for the different stakeholders that the organization is serving. But then more broadly, when it comes to power, I want to again echo your point, Terence, which is that indeed power is not a zero-sum game. Think about the relationships that you have in your life, right? It's a matter of balance. In some of those relationships, the other party has more power than you do, and in others, you have more power than they do. But it could be that tomorrow you'll gain ever more power, or that they will gain more power. But if they gain more power, it doesn't mean that the power you have completely disappeared. Again, it's a matter of balance. It's not zero sum. And you have to run the analysis. You have to understand what people need and want. And you have to understand who controls access to these resources so that you can assess the balance of power. Don't make the assumption, again, that it's all or nothing. It's a matter of balance. Yes, it may be unbalanced, but you need the more nuanced analysis of this relationship. So a misconception, at least that's an additional one, is this idea that somehow if you gain more power over me, it means that I've lost all the power I had over you. No, that's not that simple. It's a question of balance in a power relationship, and you need to run the analysis. And you should never assume that if someone has some power over you, it means you have zero power. There's always something you can do to gain a measure of power and to increase some of the power you have. And that comes, again, from the fundamentals of power. What can you do? Well, you could try and convince people that the resource you have to offer to them is more important to them than what they thought. Right? Marketing professionals do that all the time.
Yeah.
What else could you do? You could just try and make the resource you have to offer more of the kind of scarce resources for other people. What could you do to do that? Well, you're going to create some kind of strategic alliance so that now you're working with other people and it becomes harder for the person you're trying to influence to have access to the resources if they don't go through you.
Right.
Think about, by the way, some of the quasi-monopolies we have around us today.
Oh,
right?
My.
Think
yes.
About Facebook. Think about Amazon.
Yeah.
If you let these organizations grow and acquire other organizations, then your power as a consumer is fairly limited. You have to go through them. That's a consolidation strategy. They're using it, but they're not the only ones. Workers getting together as part of unions are also using a consolidation strategy. And then what you can do as you think about the balance of power is not only think about how you can increase your power, but also how you can potentially decrease the power of the other party. So what could you do? It could be that they have a resource to offer to you that has been important to you up until now, but maybe you can decide to turn your back and just realize that you don't need that resource as much. And if so, you're not as dependent on them as you thought you were. Like maybe you're quitting your job and you're going to find another one. And yes, your company had a lot of power over you up until now, but then it doesn't anymore. And then the other thing that you can do to try and decrease the power of the other party over you is actually look for alternatives to access the resources that you need. And again, let's take the situation in which you're employed, and maybe it is that you want to negotiate something internally and you'd like to have some better working conditions. Well, some people go outside and look for other opportunities and generate job offers, and then you go back to the table and you have alternatives. And that gives you some power, it decreases the power of the other party. So again, there's always something you can do to try and gain a measure of power in a given situation. So never, never assume that it's a zero-sum game, that if the other party has power, then you have none.
This has to be my final question. And it's kind of as we get to the end of the book. Do you agree with my assessment that your ultimate vision is collective action to remake society by shifting social and political and economic power imbalances?
Absolutely. The challenges we're facing are complex ones. And if we want to address those issues we've been discussing since the beginning of our conversation, systemic racism, sexism, if we want to save democracy, if we want to reduce economic inequalities, if we want to save the planet, then we're going to have to go against existing power hierarchies and create new rules of. And it's not something that we can do by ourselves, because we do not have individually all the resources that would be needed to make that kind of change happen. But we can make that kind of change happen if we join forces as part of collective movement. Right? Shifting power hierarchies is hard, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. Because what we human beings have created, we can change. Now, this is what change makers who are part of movement have understood. They've understood that by getting together, they can have so much more impact. Let me give you an example. For the book, we interviewed Shiye Batista, an organizer for Fridays for the Future in New York City,
mm-hmm.
who planned with our co-organizers the September 2019 march for which Greta Thunberg joined in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of these young people who are part of Fridays for the Future, they are great examples of agitators, right? The agitators in collective movements get together to demand that we take urgently needed action, in this case, to tackle the climate crisis. But what I want to put emphasis on is that when it comes to collective movements for change, agitation is indeed absolutely critical, and we need agitators. But we do not only need agitators. We also need innovators and orchestrators. Because what successful movements have in common is that we get to see that they are effective at agitation, innovation, and orchestration. You cannot only criticize the status quo. What you also have to do is suggest an alternative. And this is what innovators are doing. They're proposing alternatives to the status quo. They are the ones developing the concrete avenues for change, right? Such as, for example, cheaper solar technology or improved electric car batteries. You could also be thinking about policymakers coming up with new policies that are going to help protect the environment. But beyond the agitators and beyond the innovators, you also need the orchestrators. The orchestrators are those who help implement the new solutions at scale and ensure their adoption. They can be representatives of public authorities, members of civil society, as well as business or social sector representatives. These orchestrators enable the coordination and collaboration of all the parties involved. Without them, the final act kind of never comes. And so what we have to be thinking about as we think about the challenges we're facing are the roles that we can all as citizens play, right? Some of us are more effective agitators, others are more effective innovators, others are more effective orchestrators, others are able to play multiple roles at once. But we all have a role to play as part of collective movements for change. And it is a moment in time when these movements are so critically important, because if we stay the course, we know what will happen. It's been documented by studies in sociology and in economics, right? If we continue with the same kind of neoliberal system that has been dominant up until now, we will further increase inequalities. We will further destroy the planet, right? And we will further increase political instabilities. And at the end of the day, everyone will lose.
That's right.
Including the people at the top of that system, which is what they need to realize. And so shared prosperity, a society that's going to be greener, fairer, and more democratic, has to be the future if we want to be able to continue to live in harmony with each other and with the planet. And that's not going to happen magically. That's going to take work, collective action, and concertation, and that will require agitation, innovation, and orchestration.
Excellent. And that is why you wrote the book.
It is.
It is.
And you were right to say, I was genuinely touched, Terence, at the beginning when you gave that overview, because we didn't want to write a how-to book. We wanted to provide all of the principles, all the fundamentals of power, but then we wanted to connect the interpersonal level to the organizational and societal level. And we wanted for the book to also be a call to action, hoping that citizens, you know, our readers would then want to go and do more as part of those collective movements. So yeah. I hope the book will be helpful to them.
I highly recommend this book. And it's not a long book. I believe 246 pages and a lot of that and a lot of pages footnotes. I mean, it's not a long book, but it covers all of those bases. It builds. And I will say that I thought, oh, this is what this book is. And then I'd go, well, no, it's a bit more than that. And it's the way that you provide not only tools for individual lives, but a vision for, as I say, remaking society. The new book is Power for All, How It Really Works and Why It's Everyone's Business. To learn more, go to powerforallbook.com. That's one word, powerforallbook.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. All one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and probably 10 relevant and timely articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at those sites and at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, on and on. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Finally, thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Julie Batalana. Keep up your good work.
Thank you so much.